It's 6 after 10. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. My guest this hour says personal change isn't the same thing as political change. We're going to spend the rest of our time here this morning finding out what he means by that. Joining me by phone is Derek Jensen, environmental activist and author of What We Leave Behind and Songs of the Dead. Good morning, Mr. Jensen, and welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, the title of your article in Orion Magazine, which is that was the genesis of this particular program, is Forget Shorter Showers, Why Personal Change Does Not Equal Political Change. What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't think that there are very many people who would have thought that, composting or recycling would have stopped Hitler or gotten people out of Tsarist prisons or helped to pass the Voting Rights Act. Yet somehow today, when faced with the murder of the planet, we fall back into the absurd idea that somehow if I buy compact fluorescents or something that will make a significant difference. And that's really, in the 1980s was the first time that the corporate media called human beings consumers more often than it called them citizens. And that's a huge and wrenching change, because if you accept that redefinition of yourself, then your range of possible resistance is much narrower than it is as a citizen. If you're a consumer, then basically you can buy and not buy. And if you perceive yourself as a citizen, you have a much wider range of resistance. And there's an even more wrenching change that took place, several thousand years ago, which is when we accepted a redefinition of ourselves from human animals who need habitat and who live in communities to citizens of a nation state. And once again, your range of resistance is much narrowed. So part of it is about how we identify. And then another part is just recognizing that, for example, if I want to reduce my waste, that I can, personally live very simply, and the average American produces about 1,660 pounds of waste a year, and I could, reduce that to zero by wearing my tennis shoes until they fall off and repairing my toaster and so on. But what is conveniently forgotten in all this, and I think there's sort of a campaign of systematic misdirection, too, is that personal waste only accounts for about 3% of the total waste that's produced per capita in the United States. 97% of the waste is produced by industry. And it's the same with water consumption. We always hear that, I should take shorter showers because we're running out of water. Well, the truth is that 90% of the water used by humans is used by agriculture and industry. And municipal golf courses use the same amount as municipal human beings. And so, once again, I'll give one more example of this real quickly, that in An Inconvenient Truth did a very good job of presenting the sort of an introduction to global warming. But then when it came to solutions, this happens every time in all these films, that it falls apart at the level of solutions, because what it does is suggest purely personal solutions, and buying compact fluorescents, inflating your tires, and so on, but doesn't talk about the corporations that control the government, and doesn't talk about the growth economy that's really killing the planet. I mean, you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. That's unless you're either an economist or someone who is just outright crazy insofar as there's a difference, it's easy to recognize that you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. But once again, it's like sleight of hand, where there's this great problem, but then, you go back to this supposed to be this purely personal solution. And one final thing on this, which is that you know, Rosa Parks, we always hear the name Rosa Parks in terms of the bus boycott, but Rosa Parks acting by herself would have simply ended up in jail. But Rosa Parks, with the entire African-American community organized behind her, brought the bus companies to their knees. And so that's really sort of just a great example of the importance of organization for this.
I want to go back to your comments regarding our change in status, first from human animals occupying the planet to citizens of nation states, and then from citizens to consumers. You talked about resistance. Resistance against what?
Well, the most obvious answer is the sort of corporate government interlock that's long since strangled democracy, and that is strangling the planet. I mean, I used to teach at Eastern Washington University. It's a fairly conservative school, and when I would ask my students, do you believe that we live in a democracy, they would just laugh. I mean, it's a silly question. I mean, everybody knows we don't live in a functioning democracy. And I would ask, so does the government take better care of corporations or individual human beings? Once again, they would laugh. It's just a silly question. Everybody knows that the government takes better care of corporations. And is there a relationship between wealth and power? And the answer, of course, and I don't mean monetary power even, but political power. And the answer, of course, is yes. People recognize that we don't live in a functioning democracy at all. I mean, it's we can all see this with the whole healthcare thing that's going on. We can see this with all sorts of problems that we see that money talks. We live in a plutocracy, and or we could also say we live in a kleptocracy, where you know it's a government based on theft, where the governing principle is the privatization of profits and the externalization of costs. So what am I talking about resistance to? I'm talking about a resistance to the corporate governmental interlock that entirely disallows any sort of democratic, reasonable democratic or communal decision making. I mean, I was doing a benefit down in Las Cruces, New Mexico, a couple years ago for a community organization that was organizing to, or had already organized to attempt to prevent yet another toxic waste dump being put into a small community of people of color, of Mexican Americans in this case, and of poor people especially. And they had done a lot of civil disobedience, and they'd done a lot of other work, and the cops were continually arresting them for attempting to stop this distant corporation from putting distant waste into their that came from industry into their community. And we stopped and we said, so what would it look like if instead of the police enforcing the economic will of this distant corporation, what would it look like if the police were supposed to protect your community, if the police were not arresting you, but they're arresting the those who are attempting to inflict this distant economic will on you? What if the police were enforcing cancer-free zones? What if the police were enforcing clear-cut-free zones? What if the police were putting in place, what if they're putting in place rape-free zones, for that matter? It's like I got a letter from a policeman after my book Endgame came out, and he said, you know, I agree with a lot of the things you say, but I feel like there's a misrepresentation of police in there, which is interesting because I don't really talk that much about police. But he said, you know, our job is to protect people from sociopaths. And I wrote back to him and I said, yeah, that's true. And I totally agree. And when my mom's house got burgled, you know, the first thing she did was call the police. And that's all, and they caught the guy who did it. It's all great, you know. But having said that, why is it that when there's a strike, the police are called out to bring the strikers to terms? Why don't the police ever come out to bring the capitalists to terms? And why is it that when there's some sort of, you know, anti-globalization protest or anti-WTO protest, why is it that the cops are always aiming their guns at the people? Why is it that the cops don't turn their guns around and aim them at the WTO representatives who, you know, the cops actually have much more in common in terms of class with the people that they're aiming their guns at than they do the WTO representatives. You know, so the job of the police is to, and what they do most is they, you know, protect us from, you know, meth addicts or something. But the most important role that they play is to enforce the will of capital. That's not what they do most of their time. Most of their time, once again, is, you know, stopping speeders or whatever. But the most important social function they play is to enforce the will of capital. And that's, so what's the resistance to? The resistance is to, I mean, it's pretty stunning, really, that I don't understand why more, you know, even right-wing sort of patriot types don't get even more upset than they do. There's a, I live out in Northern California, and sometimes I drive over to Southern Oregon. It's just across the border, and much of Southern Oregon is pretty conservative, and there's this one sign by the highway that says, U.S. out of the U.N., which it's always, oh my gosh, you know, that's very interesting. But I've always wondered why the sign doesn't say, obviously the person's very, very conservative. I've always wondered why it doesn't say, you know, U.S. out of the WTO, because that's, I mean, the WTO is explicitly, they get all excited about U.S. sovereignty, but the WTO is certainly undermines sort of national sovereignty. And so my point is that makes corporations explicitly more important as a governing force than governments. And we know we can talk. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, we need to take a break, and then I want to come back and invite callers to join our discussion here, because I'm sure that there are a lot of people who'd love to talk to you this morning. I'm talking with Derek Jensen, environmental activist and author of What We Leave Behind and Songs of the Dead. He's also the author of an article in the current issue of Orion magazine titled Forget Shorter Showers, Why Personal Change Does Not Equal Political Change. We'll be right back to continue our discussion. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 20 minutes after 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on this afternoon on the Ideas Network. The U.S. Postal Service is considering shutting down selected offices as it continues to battle financial problems. After 4, join Ben Marins and his guests as they discuss the struggling U.S. Postal Service. That's after 4 o'clock today. This hour, we have something else on our minds. My guest is Derek Jensen, environmental activist and author of What We Leave Behind and Songs of the Dead. His recent article in Orion magazine talks about the difference between personal change and political change. And we've spent some time so far talking about resistance and against what or who. One of the things, Derek, that you mentioned, you talked about, you know, the police and who they should be looking at. The police department basically exists to enforce the law that's passed by whatever constituted authority, whether you regard it as legitimate or not. And the Supreme Court has said that corporations have the same rights as human beings. And so what do you do then?
I think that there are multiple approaches to that. One is that, you know, any unjust law should not be obeyed, doesn't need to be obeyed. Just like, and this is true, and should not be enforced. And it's absurd to say that corporations are beings. And you know, the original law that not the original law, but the original court case in which that was tried. It's very interesting. Back in the 19th century, Santa Clara versus Southern Pacific Railroad, I think, and the judge in that case actually owned stock in the Southern Pacific Railroad, which, you know, at this point is neither here nor there. But you can, once again, organize politically. I want to back up a little bit. I want to say that I'm not saying, by the way, that social change, or I'm sorry, that personal change is a bad thing. What I'm saying is insufficient. And, you know, I live pretty simply myself, but that's not a powerful political statement. It's simply because I'm kind of a cheapskate. And now back to the corporate thing, that there's some great work being done by Thomas Lindsay, for example, to attempt to de-charter corporations. And there's also some townships that he's helped in southwestern or western Pennsylvania that they've passed laws, for example, in their locality saying that they don't want, I believe, mining, and also they don't want CAFOs, you know, the confined animal so-called farms, the factory farms. And it'll be very interesting to see what happens as those go through the court system. Those are being challenged in court. And it's actually very interesting that you bring that up, because I was just thinking about, you know, remember back when Sarah Palin was asked about Supreme Court decisions that she disagreed with? I was thinking about two, you know, oddly enough, right before you called, that I very much disagreed with. Of course, it was Dred Scott. And then there was another one. It was Marshall versus somebody, I don't remember who, that was about the theft of Indian land. And basically the Supreme Court, this is in the 1820s or 30s, the Supreme Court said that, you know, yeah, it may be a drag that we've taken the land from the Indians, but once the land's been taken and once your entire society is based on it, that's tough. It becomes the law of the land. And so that's really important to recognize that. I think the first step that we have to do in terms of, you know, what do we do about this, is to recognize that just because something is a law, that doesn't make it just. And go ahead.
Well, I don't want to spend too much time on this because there's so much else that we need to cover this hour. But do you really want the police deciding which laws to enforce and which ones not to?
I think that's the basis of the whole Nuremberg trials after World War II, is that the defense of the, and besides, well, two things. One is the defense of the Nuremberg trials, which they tried and failed to use, was that they were just following orders. And the second is they do this already, and it happens constantly. And it happens constantly through the court cases. I mean, right now, one-third of all African-American males in the age of 18 and 35 are under so-called criminal justice supervision. And in some cities, like Baltimore, it's over 50%. And you can't tell me that that's because, quote, lawlessness, end quote, is so much more rampant among African-American males. I mean, a lot of people talk about, I mean, look at it this way. In place, there's already the Clean Water Act. One of the things that I have done as an environmental activist is filed timber sale appeals, which is where the Forest Service puts out timber sales, and we would show how the timber sales were illegal. They would violate the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, NEPA, NFMA, and so on. And what we, as environmentalists all over the country, were able to shut down a lot of the timber sales because the timber sales were violating laws everywhere. And the response by the federal government to people doing this all over the country was, instead of recognizing that these timber sales were illegal and stopping programs, instead they passed something called the salvage rider, which made it so that any timber sale that they decided was necessary for what they called forest health would be passed and would not be subject to environmental review. And all of the timber sales that we had helped to stop because they were illegal now suddenly were legal and were rubber stamped and put through. And so a lot of people have already taken to calling police officers, not law enforcement officers, but selective law enforcement officers. There's a guy right after World War II, a congressperson, who, during some congressional hearings on war profiteering in the war, he got really frustrated, and he said, why don't we just pass a law saying that nobody with a net worth over $10 million can ever be arrested for anything? And so my point is that that's already happening, that if the Clean Water Act were being enforced routinely, then there are a lot of things that already couldn't happen. There are already laws on the books that could help solve some of the problems that we face. What about enforcement of antitrust laws, which, of course, has stopped pretty much over the last 20, 30 years? And so I'm saying that it already happens, but it happens more as a matter of official policy. Yeah, I agree that it would not be so cool if you know, an individual police officer were to walk around going, well, gosh, I don't think I'll enforce this, I do think I'll enforce that. But like I said, it already happens. It also happens quite often on you know, there was this program on television a while ago that at first I thought was kind of cool, and then after that it started really bothering me. It was called To Catch a Predator. And they would set up stings to catch people who had tried to have sex with, to rape, really, underage, 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, whatever. And at first I thought it was really cool that they were bringing attention to these sexual predators. But then I all of a sudden realized that it was kind of a sense of misdirection, because most of sexual abuse happens not by some, you know, weirdo who's on the internet, but most sexual abuse is done by people closer, is done by those known to their victims, the fathers, the older brothers, the babysitters, the preachers. And it felt like this was attempting to sort of misdirect away from that. And what I'm trying to get at with this is that, you know, at the same time that police are being used to, you know, stop strikers or whatever, to enforce the law in that way, only 6% of rapists ever spend even a single night in jail. You know, there's extraordinary, you know, my father is extremely violent, and things have gotten much better since I was a child. But when my mom would call the police, it wouldn't do any good at that point, especially. Once again, things are better, but they're still not great. There's still tremendous selective law enforcement there. Or what happens, here's a great example, is that when this happens all the time in California, I'm presuming everywhere, is that if somebody were to strike a police officer, you know, they're gonna go down for a long time. But when police officers, between 4 and 6 Americans die every day because they encounter police, that's through beatings, shootings, high-speed chases, and medical neglect in prisons and jails. And I'm not complaining about, you know, if a cop goes to investigate a domestic violence situation. All the cops I've talked to about this say that's the most scary part, because that can be really crazy. If they go there and, you know, somebody flips out, pulls a gun on them, and they shoot the guy, I'm not complaining about that. But there was a case in California where, you know, a woman called about her son was having an epileptic seizure. She called the 911. The cops came and shot the guy. And you see, hear about cases like that all the time. And quite often, it's extremely difficult to prosecute. So it's already very selective.
Well, let's steer this discussion back more toward in the environment, which is kind of where we came from. Here's an email from Lisa in La Crosse. I think it will advance our discussion a little bit. In teaching individuals to act responsibly, you create a way of thinking. My children are aware of ways to conserve, and I believe they will take that with them the rest of their lives and use it when making decisions in their career within any company. If you just have the businesses punished or regulated to be responsible, they will only do what is necessary. Someone who understands conservation will do it in good conscience. Perhaps the bigger problem is the fact that most people don't even have a conscience anymore.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And I want to be really clear that I'm not saying that one should not attempt to educate to help to foster love for the natural world and love for the land where one lives. What I'm saying is that personal changes alone are insufficient. I think it's wonderful that she's doing this. And then all I'm saying is that, in addition, part of love is protecting one's beloved from those who threaten. And so in addition to making one's own choices in that way, I'm just adding another step, which is to organize politically to protect whatever or whomever you love. That if there is if I love the salmon and I write a lot about the salmon and I can do what I can to help, and I am doing what I can to help rehabilitate a stream near where I live, and that by itself is insufficient. In addition, we need to organize to help take out the dams on the Klamath River, and we need to organize to help the salmon in other ways that have nothing to do with my own personal decisions.
Let's take a call from Kurt in Springbrook.
Hi,
Kurt. Good morning.
Good morning. Do you mind if I change my question from what it initially was?
Go ahead.
A while back, and this kind of goes with the email that you read, John, a while back, Derek wrote about, in a language older than words, I believe, that we all kind of suffer from this level of post-traumatic stress. I'd like to hear him talk about that, because I think that gets to what Lisa was talking about, that we've lost our conscience. We've kind of been driven mad by this whole thing. I'd like to hear him talk about that.
Derek?
Okay, is it back to me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, thanks for that question, too. And Judith Herman, in her book Trauma and Recovery, talks about something she calls complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And regular PTSD is if you've been traumatized once. You know, you were sexually assaulted in a certain type of car, in which case, you know, that car might trigger you. Or, you know, you were in an earthquake, and now if you feel a rumble, then that will scare you. And then what Judith Herman asked is, what if you're not traumatized once, but you're traumatized systematically? What if you're a political prisoner and traumatized for years at a time? What if you know, you were a Vietnam vet is the classic example. Or what if you were raised in a household with a lot of violence? What happens then? And she says that not only are there specific triggers then, but in addition, you can come to believe that that all relationships are based on power. If you're a prisoner for 40 years, 30 years, you could come to believe that all relationships are based on power and hierarchy, and you can come to distrust certain forms of intimacy, and you can come to believe that non-hierarchical relationships aren't even possible. And in the book that he mentioned, A Language Older Than Words, one of the sort of central unstated theses of that book is that we as a culture have become really traumatized, and we're afraid of having intimate relationships. And especially in what I do with that book is I talk about that with the land where we live and with non-humans. And whenever I talk to indigenous people, one of the first things that they say oftentimes is that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners view listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really works, such that the world consists of objects to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into a relationship with, where a tree can talk, a tree can speak to you, and the land itself will speak to you.
Well, that sounds an awful lot. Well, that sounds an awful lot like a discussion I had yesterday with one of the authors of the book Right Relationship, which that refers to a Quaker principle, that the idea is that we need to understand our relationship to one another and to our environment and have a right relationship with that, and that will cause us to act differently. And well, he was talking about creating an entirely different economic system than the one we have now, which is based on unlimited growth and unlimited use of the resources of the planet.
And yeah, that's really interesting. And can you tell me what their definition, very briefly, what their definition of right relationship would be then?
Boy, I didn't know there was going to be a quiz today. I'd have to go back and look at my notes yesterday. What I do recall is that the word commonwealth was in it, and I wanted to go back to something that you said earlier. You talked about, you know, we need to care about the earth we live in. What about caring for each other? I mean, if we cared about each other, we wouldn't do some of the things that we do. And the Lisa's a point about we don't have a conscience. You know, if we're going to survive on the planet, don't we have to start caring about what happens to each of us, not just ourselves? I mean, isn't that one of the problems with the consumer society, is that we're focused on me? We're, you know, it's what I want right now. I have to have it, whatever this is. If I have to borrow money to get it, whether it's one company buying another company or one person going out and buying an appliance or something they can't afford, we're so focused on what we want immediately right now that we just kind of forget about what that effect is on everybody else, including perhaps someone who works in a sweatshop in some third world country.
Oh, that's absolutely true, and that's a wonderful point too, and that's one of the another of the problems of sort of the logic of capitalism is that, you know, if I can you know, buy one I don't know, buy one shirt, to use the sweatshop example. If I can buy one shirt that's made, you know, union made in the United States, and it costs, you know, $18, and I can buy a shirt that's made by in sweatshops and with exploitative labor, and it costs $2, you know, unless I've got, and otherwise the shirts are identical, you know, unless I've got an extra $16 that I can blow, you know, the logic is pretty clear and pretty inescapable on a large scale. And I can, once again, personally buy this other shirt, but that runs us up into this problem again of personal versus social change, because I can do that, but that doesn't alter the fact that there's going to be, you know, the logic is there for everyone else. And so that goes back to the importance of you know, organizing. And then there's one more thing I wanted to say about this. Oh, yeah, which is that in my book, What We Leave Behind, one of the things I talked about, I thought was pretty interesting, was that I think we have two sets of consciences, really. We have sort of an external conscience and an internal conscience. And the external conscience might not even be called a conscience, which is we don't do things for, you know, obviously an infinite number of reasons, but I'm going to break it down into four very quickly, which is that an external conscience would be the things I don't do because I don't want to get caught. And an internal conscience would be the things that I do or don't do because it's not right. And a really quick and silly example of that is, honestly, I would not shoplift from Walmart because I wouldn't want to get caught. And on the other hand, I would never shoplift from an independent bookstore because, you know, to do so is, or any independent store, you know, any local mom and pop store, because to do so would be wrong. And we have, I was just thinking about this yesterday, that is a good part of what is wrong with this culture, is that in a lot of senses, you know, if you don't get caught, it's not wrong, is some of the ethos for much of this culture, and that's no way to run a culture.
Here's an email from Annie in Spooner. She says, what is the difference between sabotage, violence, and terrorism? And do you ever worry about being labeled an eco-terrorist?
I'll answer the second part first, which is I don't worry about being labeled an eco-terrorist because there was an editorial in the San Francisco Chronicle a few years ago in which they labeled an insect a terrorist because it was affecting the profits of the wine industry. So, you know, that's a term that gets thrown around so much and it's demeaned so much that it ends up almost being meaningless. And so far as the what were the three options? Sabotage, violence, and terrorism. Okay, terrorism I define as any act that attempts to induce change in another by causing terror. And what that means is that, corporal punishment would be, and I'm using this really value neutrally, corporal punishment would be a form of sort of personal terrorism then, that you're attempting to scare the child into acting differently. And sabotage could not be terrorism because you're not attempting to scare somebody. You're attempting to destroy some piece of equipment. And violence could or could not be terrorism, depending on whether one is attempting to... So capital punishment, if you say that you're attempting to stop other... If you're attempting to simply kill Ted Bundy because you don't think Ted Bundy should be on the world, that would not be terrorism. That would be violence. But if you're attempting to kill Ted Bundy to stop somebody else from killing because they'd be scared of getting sent to the electric chair, or to the electric chair in his case, then that would be terrorism.
We need to take a break, and then when we come back, we have full phone lines, so we'll be taking calls the rest of the hour. You can also send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. We're talking today with Derek Jensen, environmental activist and author of What We Leave Behind and Songs of the Dead. He also wrote an article in Orion magazine, which was the genesis for this program, titled Forget Shorter Showers, While Why Personal Change Does Not Equal Political Change. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:44. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hey, Larry Mueller is in after 11, and in his show today, he's going to be talking about the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, a UW-Madison professor of wildlife ecology. That's always fun. That's coming up in the next hour with Larry Mueller. This hour, we're talking with Derek Jensen, environmental activist and author of What We Leave Behind and Songs of the Dead, about the difference between personal change and political change. Full phone banks. Let's go to Rich in Rhinelander first. Rich, good morning.
Good morning. I tuned in a bit late, so if this has already been covered, one or both of you will tell me, but part of the PTSD syndrome in the United States of America and perhaps in the Western world is the corruption of language. The idea that we live in a capitalistic system is widely shared. However, if it is a capitalist system, it is in contradiction of original or traditional understanding of capitalism. And right now, we're being brutalized by the implication of socialism attached to any notion of the commons or the common good. The city of Milwaukee, for at least a third of a century, operated very democratically with socialists in office and with socialist thinking. However, I don't understand why people aren't marching on Washington in droves right now, because out of anger, people like Ralph Nader are seen as radicals in terms of their description of what has happened in the culture. But we're paying to save people from failure at the top of the stack in American capitalist culture. And we're also demonizing people who say we need public health care for the common good, we need education, public, et cetera. I'll stop there. But essentially, your author, I think, touched a bit on this. Capitalism originally was supposed to lead to the very best outcomes by the choices that people make. We've skewed it so much that people who are supposed to fail no longer fail, and people who fail under a corrupted system are demonized for their unemployment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Derek?
Well, I'm not precisely sure where the question is, but I'll just take a stab at something, which is that, you know, we hear all the time about how it's a free market economy and so on, but there's a great quote by Duane Andreas, who was head of Archer Daniels Midland, who said that, you know, the free market doesn't really exist. There's not a, you know, not a grain of anything is sold through the free market on the big scale. You know, what we do have is, you know, as you sort of were alluding to, you know, massive corporate welfare. And without massive subsidies, the whole capitalist structure would fall apart pretty quickly. That really it is, I mean, how the government is run, or how the government slash economy is run, is through these massive subsidies. And that's something that just kills me, is you know, we hear that, you know, you can't subsidize this or that, that would be some form of socialism, some form of bad thing. But once again, you know, the military is subsidized heavily. And I thought it was really interesting at the beginning of the movie Sicko, where he pointed out that, you know, you don't have to pay for, I mean, firefighting is considered a social good, and so that is put forward, paid for by society at large, and yet healthcare, for example, isn't. And so it's just very interesting and scary, quite often, what is chosen to be subsidized and what is chosen not to be subsidized. And those are conscious decisions that are made at the largest level.
Mike in Whitefish Bay, you'll be next up this morning. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. I have a story that I think illustrates the difference between personal and political effectiveness in getting things done. I was with the Marines in Vietnam, and when I came home, I was at home. I was still serving, but I had an attack of an acute kidney stone, so that's a pretty compelling thing. So I went to the nearest hospital, was treated, and had surgery. And I submitted the bill to the Armed Forces. I was still a member of the Armed Forces at the time, and they have a Shampus policy that's supposed to pay all your bills, your medical bills. Anyway, they denied the bill because I didn't go 85 miles away to a military hospital to have it done. So I fought with them for 2.5-3 weeks. I was convalescing from the surgery. I didn't anyway, they stonewalled me all the time. Finally, my wife got sick of it, and she went to Madison and parked her butt in Senator Proxmire's office for 4.5 hours until they finally let her talk to him. She told him about it. This is a senator now. The next morning, the Great Lakes Naval Hospital called me, apologetically told me everything was a misunderstanding. They'd pay for the whole medical bill. So that's personal compared to political influence.
All right. That's great.
Here's an email that I think really gets at where I'd like this discussion to maybe go for the remaining minutes that we have. And this is from April in Albuquerque, New Mexico, obviously listening online. How do we begin to unravel the relationship that allows a corporation to destroy our natural resources for profit?
Wow, that really gets to the heart of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's why I read it.
I think that we have to act on many levels, and I think that I can't answer that question for April because I don't know what her gifts are. And what I can say is that we need to, there's two parts. One of them is, you know, find what it is that you love and then defend that however you need to. And the other is, what are your gifts, and what are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? And the reason I'm saying it all this way is because I don't, people have said that I should quit writing and become an organizer, but those people have never seen my workspace. I mean, I can't even organize pens, much less an entire organization. And on the other hand, I can write books. And we were trying to stop a developer from destroying the forest right near where I live. And I was out there with a wetland specialist that we in the neighborhood had hired to try to help us determine if it was wetlands, which would make it easier for us to stop the guy. And I'm out there with the guy, and he's digging in the dirt, and then he's rubbing the soil between his fingers and figuring out the color of the soil, which would then help him determine whether they were wetland soils. And he's doing this, and I look at him, I say, "Do you get off on this?" And he starts laughing and says, "Yeah, this is my second favorite thing to do in the world after playing with my dogs." And I start laughing then, and I say, "You know, I wouldn't like to do this every day. Instead, I get off on trying to figure out the relationship between perceived entitlement, exploitation, and atrocity. You know, I'd condemn myself to a life of homework." And we all have different gifts that we can bring to this struggle. And so part of it is to figure out what your gifts are and then to use them in defense of your community. You know, sometimes people have said, "Gosh, Derek, why are you writing books instead of blowing up dams?" And my only D in college was in quantitative analysis chemistry lab, so you don't want me anywhere near explosives. But on the other hand, you know, I can do what I do. And so the big dividing line is not between, you know, sometimes people talk about, "Oh my gosh, militant resistance, violent resistance, nonviolent resistance," all this stuff. The big dividing line is not between those who would use some sort of militant resistance versus those who would not. The big dividing line is between those who do something and those who do nothing. And so how do you protect the land where you live? See, that's a more interesting question, I think, a more important question. How do you protect that land from some corporation? And the way you do it is by doing it. And by, if you're an organizer, organizing. If you're not an organizer, then help someone else who is a better organizer to do so. And learn what your skills are and just start doing whatever it takes. You know, sometimes I'll say, you know, we need to use whatever means are necessary to protect the land where we live. And sometimes when I say that, people go, "Oh my gosh, does that mean militant resistance?" And sure, it can mean militant resistance, but also it can mean going down to the courthouse and pouring through county zoning regulations, which is not nearly so exciting as grabbing a pitchfork and storming them a seal, but it's just as important. And I want to be very clear, I'm not talking against militant resistance. What I'm saying is we need to have a whole culture of resistance where we say, "This is not going to happen," and then we in our communities figure out how we're going to make it not happen and how we're going to make what we want to happen happen, and then using the system when appropriate to make things not happen that we don't want to happen, instead of not happen that we don't want to happen, using the system when appropriate to defend the places we live and to defend our notion of democracy, and when it's appropriate, not using the system. And so how do we get corporations to stop destroying the natural world? I don't think we do, because corporations are psychopathological by definition. I mean, corporations are set to maximize profit. That's what they do. And to expect a corporation not to maximize profit a corporation is a tool, just like a gun, just like a hoe. And so to expect a corporation to do other than maximize profits at the expense of communities, human and non-human, is to expect for a gun to give birth or to dig a hole. You know, it's to expect a tool to do other than what it's made for. So how do we get corporations to stop doing it? We don't. What we do is we stop corporations. Corporations are legal fictions. We need to ultimately stop corporations from existing. There's no reason a corporation should exist. A limited liability corporation exists as an acknowledgement that the effects, they were the first developed really because they realized that the effects of some economic activity would be so large that the people involved couldn't be held responsible. I mean, corporations are a tool for limited responsibility. That's what they are. And we need to get rid of that notion at every level. If I ran for president, part of my platform would be, to depersonalize corporations and to de-charter corporations. Why is it that you can have three strikes, you're out on a human being, but with a corporation, which does far more damage, gets, 3,798 strikes, and it's still swinging away?
We only have about 30 seconds left of the program. People need to act individually, but they also need to act collectively. How can they get together?
Well, one of the things, the way I started with activism is, I mean, there were other parts too, but part of what I did is just went up to a local organization and started volunteering, and that's partly helpful, but I've also known people who will start to do that, but they find that the organizations aren't doing what they believe should happen. So what they do is they just start organizing them in their community. Heck, the neighborhood here where we're talking about us stopping the developer, what we did is we found that this guy was going to come in and do stuff that we didn't want to have happen, and so we just got together in people's living rooms, you know, and drank water or coffee or tea or something and talked about what are we going to do.
And we're going to have to leave it there.
Great.
Because we're out of time. Thank you very much, Derek Jensen. Appreciated the hour with you today.
Thanks. It was fun. Thank you.
Derek Jensen, environmental activist, author of What We Leave Behind and Songs of the Dead. This program was produced by Robert Schrader and, Jolima Noel handled on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.